Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, Asian markets turned bearish in the Greek financial crisis. An analyst speaks with us about the Iran nuclear talks dragging on. Love locks are causing something of a problem, but they're still romantic.
Every time that I saw this ritual, I was helplessly charmed. It's so wonderful and it's so sincere.
And a new movie looks at love and violence amidst the world of illegal drugs. It's coming up here on The Voice of America. Concerns about the Greek financial crisis widening to affect the global financial system prompted widespread selling of stocks in Asia today. VOA correspondent Steve Herman is in Bangkok monitoring the situation. Steve, what is going on?
Well, this region was obviously the first that was able to react to all the surprise announcements that came out of Athens in the middle of the night their time. And the analysts I was talking to said there had apparently been some complacency in the global markets around a possible Greek exit from the Eurozone, and that was certainly shaken off in Asia today. The benchmark Nikkei index in Tokyo fell about 600 points. That's a drop of almost 3%. Korea's stock market, Kospi index in Seoul, fell about a 1.5%. The Sensex in Mumbai was also down, but not as much. But the real interesting volatility and selling was really on the Chinese markets, especially in the mainland.
What happened there?
First, we'll look at the Hang Seng, which is the Hong Kong benchmark. That was off about 2.75%. The analyst I spoke with said that some of that was Greece, but in good part, it was also some fallout from this panic selling that was happening on the volatile bourses on the Chinese mainland. There hadn't been a day in Shanghai like this for many, many years, the percentage swings. And when the gyrations were finally done, it closed down about 3.75%. But that comes after a nearly 7.5% plunge from last Friday. And then Shenzhen was also down almost 6%. And this probably would have been a lot worse if the the China Securities Regulatory Committee, the CSRC, hadn't come out with a statement during mid-session. They placed this on Sina Weibo, which is the Chinese version of Twitter, and to assure the market that the risks associated with short selling and margin trading are generally under control. That's what the statement said.
What specifically are they concerned about coming out of Greece?
I think it was around 3 a.m. Local time in Athens. There was this announcement to call for a national referendum to shut down the banks for at least 6 days, to limit withdrawals from the ATMs to, 60 euros per day. And these sort of, capital controls, I think, really came as a surprise. And, of course, this had all occurred after the European Central Bank on Sunday had announced that Greece's banks would not be receiving any more emergency loans.
Thank you so much, Steve, for talking with us.
My pleasure.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Some 8,000 light years from Earth, in the constellation Cygnus, a binary system known as V404 Cygni is bursting with activity for the first time in 26 years. This system is made up of a black hole and a star that orbit each other. The black hole is also devouring matter from its companion star. The binary system caught the attention of astronomers in June when the Burst Alert Telescope, mounted on NASA's Swift satellite, detected a sudden burst of gamma rays. Scientists from all over the world have since been monitoring the black hole and its companion star with ground-based and space telescopes. The sudden burst of activity is thought to be triggered when gathering material surrounding the black hole grows to a point that forces a dramatic change in its feeding mechanism. The last time this binary system was this active and bright was back in 1989. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you. A senior U.S. official said Sunday the negotiating teams for six international powers and Iran are expected to remain in Vienna beyond a self-imposed Tuesday deadline to reach a comprehensive nuclear agreement, suggesting the June 30th target date will not be met. My colleague Victor Beatty has been following the story and joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan.
What have you found?
British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond said there are a number of areas where there are major differences of interpretation in detailing what was agreed to in the framework accord reached in Lausanne back on April 2nd. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini spoke to reporters on Sunday.
And I would say that the political will is there. I've seen it from all sides. So we have tasked our negotiating teams to continue work immediately tonight on the text and to try and close all the issues of the translation of the political understanding that we found in Lausanne into texts that are solid enough for the coming days. So the ministers will come back here in the coming days as soon as the work on the text has moved forward to finalize the agreement. We'll stick to the deadline of the 30th, ready to interpret it in a flexible way as we did it already in Lausanne. It was needed to have a couple of days more. That is not the end of the world, but it is very clear that the deadline is going to stay end of June, beginning of July. We're going to finalize it, hopefully, in the coming days. So no extension, we all agreed on that. Everybody is very much aware of the fact that we have conditions now to close the deal, to close a good deal, and we have to use these hours, these days, to do it.
The main obstacles appear to be international access to all Iranian nuclear sites to make sure Iran is not trying to acquire nuclear weapons, and the pace in ending international sanctions that's hurting Iran's economy. Those contentious issues, University of Denver Associate Professor Jonathan Edelman told me, are the main reasons why it appears unlikely the June 30th deadline will not be met.
The Iranians want sanctions lifted, and they want them lifted very quickly after this agreement is signed. The Western position of the P5 plus one is that they can only be lifted if there is evidence that Iran is complying with these agreements. Another critical issue is nuclear inspections. There is no question that Iran has a long history of developing nuclear weapons. They're very close, everyone agrees, with less than a year, maybe 3 to 6 months, of having an atomic bomb. There needs to be two things: inspections to guarantee, then those inspections that will be held anywhere, anytime, any place, because they have every reason to avoid that. And secondly, an explanation of how they got there, because they have violated a series of UN resolutions over the years. And there's a number of others as well. There's the whole issue of terrorism. State Department just came out branding Iran as one of the major terror states. This has been largely ignored, but obviously it's very important. And finally, the Grand Ayatollah himself. He just came out 2 days ago and made clear that he was not willing to make concessions on any of these. Now, was that simply for local political consumption in Tehran, or is he very serious about that? Only time is going to tell.
Any significance to the departure of Iran's foreign minister Zarif back to Tehran after discussions in Vienna?
The problem is you could read it both ways. You could read it that they are really very disgusted in Tehran with what's going on. They had expected things to be easier for them. But then they announced that he's coming back on Tuesday to Vienna to meet with Kerry. So clearly what's going on is he has very little power. In fact, the President Rouhani has very little power. The ultimate power has always been and remains, as it did with the original Grand Ayatollah Khomeini and now with Khamenei, with the religious establishment. And he has been very clear 2 days ago that he's not going to accept any of this. Now, how much is real and how much is just posing is very hard to say. But it does mean that for one more time, we've come down to the end and we are nowhere near a conclusion one way or the other.
Associated Press writes this: both sides recognize there is leeway to extend to July 9th as part of an agreement. The U.S. Congress lawmakers there have 30 days to review a deal before suspending congressional sanctions, but postponed beyond July 9 would double the congressional review period to 60 days, giving both Iranian and U.S. critics more time to work on undermining the agreement. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely correct. In other words, there is substantial evidence in Congress, not just in the Republican Party, but led by people like Chuck Schumer and Robert Menendez and others, at least 6 to 10 Democrats, who have said, we are very concerned about this treaty. We may not vote for it. So if they can't reach an agreement by July 9th, after missing a number of deadlines before, there's no question that the person who wrote that is correct, that this is going to further inflame the elements in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, and independents for that matter, who will see this as one more proof that this is not a good deal, that it was hard to reach, and at the end of the day, concessions were made that the United States does not feel should be made.
And Edelman says Iran may be prolonging the negotiations, hoping for more Western concessions. Meanwhile, a staunch opponent of the agreement, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, on Sunday warned against what he called a stark retreat from the red lines that the world powers set themselves only recently and publicly. He said there's no reason to hasten into signing a bad deal, which, in his words, gets worse by the day.
Well, thank you very much, Victor.
All right, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, a token of love causing unexpected real problems. And love in the fast lane of the drug underworld. Love locks, romantic tokens, are being secured on bridges in some parts of the world. The padlocks, sometimes engraved with affectionate terms, proclaim a couple's unending love. But they can also weigh down on railings and threaten damage. Michael St. James is a photojournalist and author of the book Bridges of Paris. And in that city of love, the love locks are causing some problems. Welcome to our program, Michael.
Thank you very much.
You've been an eyewitness to the love lock experience. Can you tell us about it?
The love lock started appearing in Paris around 2008. And I had visited before that and during that time. And then 2010 and 2012, I was there more and watched them gradually grow. And there was a point where they actually looked very lovely. There was just a few locks on the bridges, a very romantic image. But then as I worked on my book, I lived in Paris for the last year and was there a little bit of time before that. I watched it truly have this viral effect, that the locks went from hundreds of locks to thousands of locks to 10,000s of locks, to the point where literally the whole sides of the bridges were covered in locks.
And this is dangerous because the bridges can lose their railings.
That's right, And the locks are attached to it's like a chain link fencing, mesh fence that's on the side, and that can't bear the weight of the locks. The bridges are always safe. There was a news report when when part of the parapet fell down, the meshing fell down, that the bridge had collapsed, which was kind of funny to see because the bridges really weren't at risk. But the sides will come off, and one of the big dangers is they're going to tumble right into the river, and there's lots of traffic in the river. Certainly there's tour boats there, so that could affect things.
Tell me a little bit about the couple you've seen, the ritual involved.
Let's see. The love lock ritual is just not specific to Paris. It actually happens in different countries. But basically I think we're in the city of love, and there's a natural kind of human tendency to want to kind of leave our mark there. You know, it's like scratching your name on a tree or leaving a piece of graffiti in some sense. But you're in this moment, you're with the person that you love, and so the ritual is simply to get a lock, and you write your names, both your names on the lock, and then you lock it to the bridge, hopefully locking your love forever, symbolically locking your love forever, and then you throw the key in the river and let the key drift away.
And isn't there a big smooch at the end?
The smooch, going back to the hotel room, a great meal with a lot of wine or something. It was interesting for me to see, because as much as it's destructive and the Parisians don't appreciate kind of the visual pollution that the locks create, every time that I saw this ritual, I was helplessly charmed. It's so wonderful and it's so sincere, and to know that this, you know, a couple has come all the way to Paris to lock their love. It was really just a wonderful ritual.
Well, there's a particular thing about Paris and love. How would you describe it?
There is. And I don't know if I can describe it, except that there's something about Paris that is magical. There's something about it that's alive. There's something about it that my sense was I felt all possibilities. It was part of how I succeeded in doing my book and spending a year there photographing the bridges, is that the city itself just gave me this feeling of great possibility. So to be there with someone that you love, I think that feeling is just magnified. when I first started shooting the pictures, I would notice I got some pictures of people kissing on the bridges, and I was very excited. Oh, I'll get some shots of people kissing. And after being there 6 or 7 months, people were kissing on the bridges all the time. I had to not take a picture when people were kissing because I had too many kissing pictures.
That's a problem. But it's a good problem to have, not bad. Well, thank you so much, Michael.
Well, you're very welcome.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
A solar-powered Swiss airplane is back in the air after it attempts a 35,000-kilometer trip around the world without a drop of fuel. The Solar Impulse 2 flew out of central Japan early today after an unscheduled month-long stop. The piloted plane by Swiss pilot André Borschberg, he's also one of the plane's creators, it left Nagoya, Japan for its trans-Pacific flight, the longest leg of the plane's journey. If weather conditions over the Pacific do remain favorable, the plane will be recalled. However, there will come a point of no return in the crossing of the Pacific Ocean when the aircraft will not be able to make it back to Japan again. A new movie looks at love and violence set against the background of the drug empire of Colombia's Pablo Escobar. David Byrd has this look at Escobar, Paradise Lost.
Depending on who you ask, former Colombian cocaine cartel leader Pablo Escobar was the devil incarnate, a man who cared for the downtrodden, or an international criminal. There's no denying that at one time, Escobar, known for his violent ways of handling those who opposed him, was one of the world's most wanted fugitives. His Medellin cartel shipped tons of cocaine to the United States and Europe before he was shot dead by Colombian security forces in 1993. In a new film, Escobar, Paradise Lost, director Andrea DiStefano has Oscar-winning actor Benicio del Toro playing the former drug lord. At the film's premiere, DiStefano said he didn't want to portray Escobar as some kind of romantic anti-hero. He just wanted to tell a good story.
I was a story that was told to me and inspired me to write this film. I wasn't particularly in love with Pablo Escobar. It was just... I thought that was a story like that could make an interesting thriller, a movie I would like to go and see at the movie theater.
That story has a young surfer from Canada, Nick, played by Josh Hutcherson, who's best known as PETA in the Hunger Games franchise. He moves to Colombia with his older brother, where he falls in love with Pablo Escobar's niece, played by Claudia Trasek.
All of you foreigners, come here and think that you found paradise. But I see what is wrong with it.
We do charity work for poor communities.
That's great. Who's we?
My uncle. I work for him.
Oh, Uncle Pablo.
Maria is like a daughter to me. Do you love her?
Yes. Absolutely.
Benicio del Toro says that playing someone as notorious as Pablo Escobar was fascinating, because he had to learn about the former drug lord to interpret the character.
A lot of the moments that he picked up Escobar were kind of like taking place in actual, real moments that happened in his life. When he was running for office, opening a clinic, and like the first time Josh's character sees him, he's opening this clinic for the people, for the poor people. So there was all this stuff when he goes to jail at the end that is, you know, that is... He controlled that jail. at that moment.
Del Toro is no stranger to playing controversial men. He played Argentine guerrilla leader Ernesto Che Guevara in the 2008 biopic Che. For this film, the Oscar winner says that he learned that his character had many sides and wasn't just a gangster or a thug.
That was one of the things that I kind of like. So when we see Escobar, we see the truth, his love for his family. We see him as a family man. That's how Josh's character sees him. So there's truth to the character of Escobar.
Josh Hutcherson says that his character is an amalgamation of a historical person or persons, but the story did not really happen that way.
Nick wasn't a real character. There was a, I guess, there was some secondhand account of someone that worked for Pablo that there was like a pool guy that was kind of outside the circle that sort of got brought in that wasn't Colombian. So through that, I think Andrea found the inspiration for Nick and then kind of used Nick as a metaphor for the Colombian people, sort of being romanticized by Pablo and brought into this world in this beautiful way with the caring, loving side, and then just giving it to him.
Hutcherson's character has to make some difficult choices to keep his family safe, and he also doesn't know if Uncle Pablo is there to help him or to kill him. Escobar Paradise Lost is rated R for violence and for language. I'm David Byrd.
If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States believes Chile can be an effective partner in promoting an open, interoperable, secure, and reliable Internet. In his remarks on June 18, 2015, Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Communications and Information Policy, Daniel Sepulveda, elaborated on this issue in Santiago, Chile. We have a shared responsibility to be good stewards of the Internet and must not be complacent in pursuing our vision of the future. I see three critical issues ahead on which Chile and the United States can and should work together. The first issue is access. The Internet can only be an engine for growth if it is available. Roughly 3 out of 5 people in the world remain without Internet access. That's why, 2 years ago, the United States helped to create the Alliance for Affordable Internet, a broad coalition of governments, industry, and civil society that works with policymakers to expand access while keeping prices low. The United States is also planning to work with partners to increase the adoption of fixed and mobile broadband and infrastructure. The second issue is governance. The Internet has flourished because of the bottom-up, consensus-based process that allows all stakeholders, including the private sector, civil society, and governments, to participate in its governance. This approach keeps the Internet operating in a safe, secure, and reliable manner. There are those who claim the system is broken and should be replaced by a more centralized approach, where governments have more control. But this would, in fact, stunt the growth of the Internet and slow its delivery to the rest of the world. And the third issue is stability. Cyber attacks are a real and persistent threat for all states. At the policy level, the best defense is to promote international cyber stability. That means states must seek broad consensus on what constitutes responsible and irresponsible behavior in cyberspace, with the goal of creating a climate in which all states are able to enjoy the benefits of cyberspace. The Internet has served us well, said Ambassador Sepulveda, as a platform to provide anyone connected to it with an opportunity to contribute to political, economic, and social discourse. It is the kind of freedom that Chile fought for and won. And that is why it is so important that you engage this global debate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.